Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to take part in our conversations here on the Exchange, feel free to jump in. Phone numbers as follows, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. A holiday largely centered around a meal practically begs for a discussion of food and drink, and we have succumbed to the begging for several years now. So on this Thanksgiving Eve, we'll provide the wine and cheese course, in a sense, as we talk to the authors of books on those two parts of the feast. Melanie Wagner is a wine writer, speaker, and teacher, and a certified sommelier. She lives in Chicago. Her book is Hello Wine. Melanie, hello to you.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Good to have you here. Peggy Smith worked as a chef at Chez Panisse for a long time before co-founding Cowgirl Creamery with Sue Conley. They have co-written the book Cowgirl Creamery Cooks, which is going to get me tongue-tied at least once in this hour, I'm sure. Peggy, welcome to you.
Thank you. Hi. How are you doing?
Good. Good to have you both here. There's some great history here with you and Sue Conley, as I understand it. You were freshman roommates at the University of Tennessee. Was there any interest in the restaurant business when you guys first met?
Actually, we both worked while we were in college, and restaurants were the way to go, and so we were both working in restaurants, but, you know, we were thinking more of our liberal arts degrees rather than making restaurants our career.
And so how and why was the Cowgirl Creamery born?
Well, it had a lot to do with our friend Albert Strauss, who transitioned his parents' dairy farm from conventional to organic, and he also opened a creamery where he was bottling his milk, and the milk was so good we thought it could be a fun thing to start making cheese using that milk.
And so how many different kinds of cheeses and other products do you make there?
Well, we make about, depending on the season, we usually make about 6 different cheeses.
So that's what's going on at Cowgirl Creamery. And the book, of course, Cowgirl Creamery Cooks. Melanie Wagner, for those of us whose French is weak, what does sommelier mean?
It's just a French word that means the person who takes care of the wine. Typically in a French restaurant is how it has historically been known. And then a certified sommelier means somebody who's gone through training and has taken a pretty hard test to basically say that they're a wine ninja.
How hard were the tests?
Pretty difficult, but I made it through, and now my job is to spread the joy and love of wine to other people. And I'm a huge fan of Cowgirl Creamery.
Oh, really?
I love your stuff. I started out in the wine industry in California and lived there for a long time, and I have been known to eat an entire round of Mount Tam Triple Cream Brie in one sitting.
We encourage that.
I may have been pregnant at the time, but...
That was Mount Tam Triple Cream Brie?
Oh, God, yeah.
And is that still a regular product you put out at Cowgirl Creamery?
Yeah, that's our... that's the cheese we make the most of, and we all like it, so...
Melanie, I want to go back to you for just a second, because this is not necessarily the career path that was indicated. I was trying to ask the same question of you both about what your thoughts were originally about careers before you ended up where you are now. You apparently had a degree in psychology, is that right?
I had a degree in psychology, and I was actually born in Tennessee, Sue, and grew up in Florida, went to school in Texas, but visited San Francisco in college and thought that it was the most beautiful ever, so... I moved there without knowing anybody and decided to become a teacher. So I was actually living in San Francisco, and I was a Montessori preschool teacher in Mill Valley.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, and I did that for a couple years, but I was not making it financially. It was during the dot-com boom, and I was making, you know, $10 an hour as a teacher. I loved kids, and I loved my job, but I just couldn't make it. So I had a conversation with one of the little boys' moms, one of my students, his mother, on the playground one day. She told me she was in the wine business, and she was smart, and she dressed well, and she told me that she got to taste wine every day and learn about it and travel the world and study it, and it was like, aha! The heavens opened up, and bells and whistles went off in my head, and I knew that that's what I was going to do. So I did not hesitate. I started calling distributors the next day, and most people you know, didn't either hung up on me or didn't call me back, but one person did, Paul Torres at the Henry Wine Group, and he's still one of my mentors in the wine business. And they gave me a position that they had never done before, which they're a great distributor, and they're sort of known for having an educated sales force. I was not educated. I didn't know anything about wine at the time, but they gave me the account base that nobody else wanted. I think I had 400 accounts in San Francisco that were, you know, half of them were Chinese restaurants. And my learning curve was so painful. I was made fun of by the people that I worked with, by the people that I was selling to. I cried on more than one occasion, and it takes a lot for me to admit that because I'm pretty tough. But I think, you know, I never was thinking about writing a book back then, but I think I was definitely, the more and more I learned and my teaching background, I think, and the way that I like to communicate, I was formulating my philosophy on wine, which is that, it, you know, we should eradicate wine snobs everywhere and that wine should be accessible and warm and friendly. But authoritative. I mean, you should still get accurate information, but it should be given in a kind way.
Were you even much of a wine drinker before you had that conversation in the schoolyard?
I loved to drink it when I could afford it, but I couldn't afford it very often.
All right, so we'll move on from the teaching career to the wine career and talk more with Peggy Smith as well about Cowgirl Creamery Cooks and how it came about. As we talk to Melanie Wagner about her book, Hello Wine, and to Peggy Smith about her co-written book with Sue Conley, Cowgirl Creamery Cooks, back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're spending this Thanksgiving Eve as we spend a lot of holiday eves. Our last live broadcast before the holiday usually features some discussion of food and drink, and this time is no different. We're talking to Melanie Wagner, who is the author of Hello Wine, and we're talking to Peggy Smith, the co-author with her partner Sue Conley, of the book Cowgirl Creamery Cooks, a more traditional cookbook based on cheese and other dairy products. And you can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about wine and cheese and dairy. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Melanie, I want to come back to you for just a second, because that's a provocative statement. You want to eradicate wine snobs. You don't want to get rid of the people, but you want to stop people from being snobs, apparently. So
I should say eradicate wine snobbery.
All right. In what sense, though? I mean, what makes a wine snob, and what is the behavior you're trying to undo?
You know, it's weird. We grow up in this country, and for most people, they don't grow up with wine on the table or wine being a part of the everyday discussion like in Europe. I mean, in Europe, on the table is wine is just always on the table, and it's not necessarily the focus, but it's another ingredient on the table. And so I think we grow up here with this idea of wine as being this very sophisticated, very elusive thing. And so when people learn a little bit, there is this habit that I see all the time of people sort of dangling what they know in front of others that don't know as much. And I have no tolerance for that. I think, you know, I think if you do know something about wine, the best thing that we can be doing is spreading that knowledge and making wine easier for other people to understand so that more people have access to the pleasure of wine.
And certainly a lot more people seem to be consuming wine as the years go by in the United States. And so, Peggy Smith...
We still have a lot of catching up to do.
Right. A lot of ground yet to cover. Let's grab our bottles, folks, and get busy here. So, Peggy Smith, I noticed that just to compare with other countries as well, we consume, it looks like, a pound of cheese per person per week in America. And does that mean we have catching up on cheese consumption to do as well?
Wow. Well, a pound a week? Gosh. I think that probably the French eat a little more cheese than we do, but it sounds like we might be out there in the front as well.
All right. Are there cheese snobs like there are wine snobs?
Oh, yes. I know who you're talking about, Melanie, when you're saying that. and it is a little bit of knowledge can be dangerous type thing, but the one thing about cheese making in the U.S. right now is it's a very collaborative position that people are in, and a lot of the cheesemakers that we know and work with want to share as much information as they have, and I feel like our cheesemongers are that way too. You know, they just want to educate.
I love that term, and it's, you know, sort of like a fishmonger and some of the other terms you get from Dickens books and stuff, but cheese, what does a cheesemonger do?
A cheesemonger is a person that, well, number one, helps educate the public, usually works behind a cheese counter and sells cheese, but also they help take care of the cheese in the shops.
Did you have a? I know Melanie was saying that when she first got into the wine business, she knew very, very little about it, other than that she liked to drink it from time to time. Mm-hmm. Your story is a bit different. You've been in the food business for so long, working at Chez Panisse and other places. Did you know that much though about making cheese? Was it something you sort of picked up by osmosis, or was it a real learning curve for you there as well?
Yeah, we didn't. We knew a lot about cheese, and we'd visited a lot of cheese makers and different cheese. Facilities like shops and things in Europe and in the U.S. as well, but we didn't really know about cheese making, but we figured since we were cooks, we could figure it out.
Okay, and then, but how long did it take to feel like you were really comfortable with the process?
Oh, gosh, it, you know, we're still learning and still working to perfect, so it's a craft that I think you can always get better at, and I feel like we're getting there.
Some of the things that are peculiar to the cheese business, how big is your vat? Why is that such an important question?
Well, that determines what amount of milk you're processing in the production. And, you know, some producers, cheese producers, make over 1 million pounds of cheese a day.
Wow.
Some people make cheese in a 5-gallon vat. When we first started, we had a 10-gallon vat. Which would make about, you know, just as a rough guess, it makes about 10 pounds of cheese. We now have 400-gallon vats, which are pretty small, actually, in the scheme of things. But it just kind of tells you how much cheese you're producing if we know how big the vat is.
All right. And Melanie Wagner, for you with Hello Wine, you make wine sound like a bit of a gateway drug. And I don't mean in the sense of to other drugs, but to other knowledge. How does it function in that way?
Absolutely. That was one of the first things that really intrigued me about wine was that, you know, when I was 23 and I was first entering the wine business and I had to learn all this very quickly, I would have loved to have been able to fly over to Germany and walk the vineyards or go to South America or New Zealand. I couldn't afford to do those things, but every time I opened a bottle and I studied a bottle, it was like I was connecting with that place. And I think the same thing can be said for cheese or any other artisan product, any product that has a soul. And I like when you were talking about how big your vat is, that's sort of, I think you can't make cheese or wine or any other artisan food product on a huge scale and still expect that it feels as though it has a soul.
Just because you're mass
producing.
Would
you agree
something?
With that?
I would just say that it's a much more intimate process. I do agree with it. I know that there are some producers that produce in large quantities that really have, you know, that connection you're talking about, but it's much easier to have with smaller production.
All right. So, and I want to come back to what you do at Cowgirl Creamery, Peggy, because it's not just cow products.
Well, actually, we only make cheese from cow's milk, okay. But we work with a lot of different producers around the United States because we also have a small distribution business, and we have a couple of cheese shops. So we know a lot of the producers in the United States and several in Europe. And it's actually a really good community. I think there's the same kind of kinship in the wine business. Don't you think, Melanie?
Yes. Yeah. Yep.
So you write in Cowgirl Creamery Cooks that milk and cheese will certainly taste different in different seasons. Why would the seasons matter so much?
Well, you know, every single day milk, if you were to drink cow milk from a cow every day, if you had a cow and every day you went out and milked it and you drank the milk, it would taste different every single day. And it has to do with what the cows or the animals are eating. And it's really reflected in the flavor of the milk and also in the components of the milk. I think it's like any food product that it changes with the seasons. And in the winter, when cows or the animals get a little bit more fortified feed, their milk has higher components and it's a richer milk. In the spring, you'll get really grassy flavored tones that come from the milk just because they're eating that fresh green grass and it's more vibrant. So you just pick up these flavors. I think you're going to find so many similarities between wine and cheese as far as production and a reflection of the seasons and that kind of thing.
It is sort of a natural pairing.
That's what I was talking about was as far as artisan, you know, small artisan wines or cheese with Sol, because you definitely can't pick up differences in flavors seasonally with Velveeta.
I agree.
Nor do you want to.
Velveeta and Ripple, right?
Yeah.
Right. That's where we'll steer away from that discussion. We're talking about the wine and cheese course, in essence, for Thanksgiving. Melanie Wagner's book is called Hello Wine, The Most Essential Things You Need to Know About Wine. And Peggy Smith is the co-author with her partner at Cowgirl Creamery, Sue Conley. Cowgirl Creamery cooks. There are recipes in the book. We'll get to those in just a bit. You can join us as we talk about wine and cheese and other dairy products as well. Our phone number is on the exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email jx@jeffnet.org. I know there are references in the book, Peggy, to the parts of the country that are known for dairy. I still remember the good dairy products come from Happy Cows. Happy Cows come from California,
mm-hmm.
and that's where you are. There are other regions known for dairy. What accounts though for good things coming out of cows in different parts of the country?
Well, I think it has to do with having good agricultural land. And right in your area, you all have some really great cheesemakers. You know, there's, of course, the Rogue Creamery in Medford, and then you've got a lot that are clustered around Eugene. And I know there's some really delicious goat milk cheese that comes from around Portland area. And it has to do with there being available ag land that people can still have dairy farms on, and you know, we just see that disappearing so quickly, but I think it just has to do with care of the land and there being a market for it.
Will the products taste vastly different from one part of the country to the other? I've been assuming that the process is generally the same to make a triple cream brie, for example. Will the one from Vermont taste very similar to the one coming from your farm?
You know what, it really does taste differently, and one of the things that we learned when we were making cheese is that you can have an idea in your head of what kind of cheese you want to make and how it will taste, but it really, the environment in which you make the cheese and the environment in which the milk comes from really plays such an important role in what flavors you can get from that milk and what kind of cheeses you can make, because the animals really adapt to the terrain and that will dictate what kind of cheese you can make, because you can't make every kind of cheese from any kind of milk.
Okay, we'll get into that in just a moment. But so Melanie Wagner, similar question for you about wine. I mean, you're going to notice vast differences in a Pinot Noir from Oregon and a Pinot Noir from Arkansas. I don't know.
I hope so. I hope so. That is the goal. I mean, the world of wine, probably like cheese and everything else, is becoming a little more homogenous. But yes, that's the goal, that everything tastes distinctive and unique and speaks of the terroir where it is from. And there's another fancy French word, which terroir just essentially means the natural environment in which the grape or, in, you know, the cows, if we're talking about the cows that Cowgirl Creamery uses to make their cheeses, everything that goes into the environment. So that's a very important concept in wine, in fine wines. And I always, when I'm teaching wine classes, I always like to compare how a wine ultimately tastes back to my psychology studies and my studies about child development. They always used to say, you know, how a child turns out when they're older is sort of half dependent on nature and half dependent on nurture. So, you know, genetics and then the environment. And I think the same is true with wine. I think, you know, Cabernet, for instance, Cabernet Sauvignon, is a grape that has very distinctive flavor qualities, black currant, blackberry, sometimes tobacco, and it's no matter where you plant Cabernet in the world, it's usually always going to have a little bit of those flavors. But Cabernet, thank goodness, Cabernet Sauvignon can taste vastly different depending on when it's grown in South Australia or when it's grown in Napa or when it's grown in Bordeaux. And that has to do with the terroir or the environment.
I do love that word, terroir. It's, think of it, folks, as a terror with the word, with the letter I just before the final R. Is there any relationship between terroir and terror?
I hope not. I don't think so.
All right, let's talk to some real brass tacks on wine and how to approach it. For example, you say that glasses are very important to wine and wine consumers. And for that matter, is there a better term than wine consumers? Wine drinkers?
Wine monger,
okay. Right.
No, I talk about glassware. You know, I tried to mix, as you can tell, I'm slightly have a spiritual and philosophical take on wine, so I've got that running through the book, but also there's so much practical information in Hello Wine. I really tried to edit this down to, you know, what do you really need to know when you're first getting into wine, or if you've been in wine for a if you've been drinking wine for a long time, but you're maybe kind of stuck in a rut and you want to learn something. This is the first book that someone should pick up about wine. That's why it makes such a great gift. But yes, about glassware, I do talk about glassware and how glassware is important, but I do also say that once you've got a good glass with a large bowl on the bottom, so kind of wide, so you can kind of swish and swirl your wine around in there, and it narrows up towards the top, and it's got a thin lip. Those are the really important things. After that, you really don't need to buy all these different types of wine glasses. It's not necessary. Sorry to all the people who sell multiple types of wine glasses out there, but really just one large good quality glass will do, and that's what I drink everything out of at home too. Whites, reds, pinks, they're all out of a nice Riedel Bordeaux glass.
But not sparkling wines, right? That does require
champagne. No, sparkling wines I really like. You could drink sparkling wines out of a regular wine glass. You can actually smell them a little bit better that way, but I prefer a flute, a tall, lovely flute, because it's so pretty to watch bubbles kind of dancing around in your glass.
And what does the swishing do? It's not just for visual effect. There is a real...
Sure, I'm glad you asked that. You know, I have all of these very, very important moments in my wine education where I sort of was met with that wine snobbery, and all those moments went into creating the book, ultimately, and defending people who are just getting into wine. But one of the moments that I remember, I'm not going to name the winery, but when I was very, very young, very new in the wine industry, I was visiting a Napa winery, and everybody was swooshing their wines around in their glass, and I was curious, and I asked the woman behind the counter, you know, why is this happening? Why do people do that? And she said, "We're volatilizing the esters." And that's it. That's all she said, and she walked away. And it was like somebody slapped me, because I was like, well, obviously, I am pretty dumb because I don't know what that means. But and later on, I went back and studied, and of course, technically, she's right. You're volatilizing the esters, which is you're getting oxygen mixed in with the wine, and all the chemical, all the thousands and thousands of chemical compounds that are in the wines are opening up. It's basically taking a wine from being introverted, which it usually is right when you open the bottle, to being more extroverted and easy and easier to find the flavors and the aromas. She could have said something like that, and I would have, you know, I would have had a much nicer day, but so, yeah, that's what people are doing when they're swooshing.
Okay, or for computer fans, you're unzipping the folder, I guess. So I want to.
That's pretty nerdy, Jeff. But yes,
I'll accept that. Peggy Smith. The basic question I have failed to ask up to this point is: what is cheese, and what makes, for example, Swiss and mascarpone even the same species?
Well, technically it's transforming liquid into solid, and that liquid being a milk. And mascarpone is, you know, that is a cheese that, I have a hard time calling that one a cheese myself. Hmm. But it is moving that liquid to a solid. It doesn't have a rennet. That one, usually for cheese, you have four ingredients. You have milk, salt, a coagulant, and the cultures, the enzymes that help with the flavor aspect.
Okay. We'll pick it up on the other side of a break and get further into the making of cheese. Cowgirl Creamery Cooks is the book that Peggy Smith wrote with Sue Conley, and Hello Wine is Melanie Wagner's book. We'll come back and talk about the wine and cheese course and take any phone calls and emails you'd like to join us with. That's back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about food and wine. In fact, in the same conversation, two separate cookbooks, two separate authors. Melanie Wagner in Chicago is talking to us about her book, Hello Wine. It's really about a way to get familiar with wine and to banish wine snobbery, as it's known from the world, to help you get into the knowledge of wine. Cowgirl Creamery Books is the book, Cooks, rather, is the book that Peggy Smith and Sue Conley wrote together. They're from Cowgirl Creamery in the Bay Area. You can join us here in the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about wine and cheese and dairy products. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782, and our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So we were talking, Peggy, about the cheese, the four basic ingredients, milk, salt, coagulant, and culture, and then you're moving into something called rennet?
Well, rennet is the coagulant.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have a traditional rennet, which would be enzymes that are harvested basically from a calf's stomach lining, they're microbial coagulants, and you can also have a vegetable coagulant such as thistle. So it's just what draws the proteins together.
All right, and how long does it take to make any the most basic cheese?
For us, it usually takes us about 4 hours to get the curd cut and ready to put into the molds. And then to finish a cheese like Mount Tam, it usually takes 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is this the kind of situation where if you touch it before 4 weeks, you could die?
No, you wouldn't die, but the cheese just wouldn't be as good as it could be. And there are so many steps that happen in between. The pouring the milk into the vat and wrapping the cheese to sell it. So it's a multi-step process.
All right, the very first recipe in Cowgirl Creamery Cooks is for an egg cream, which looks like a milkshake but isn't quite. Why is it even called an egg cream? Do we know?
You know what? We don't know that.
Who cares?
Because there's no egg, right?
Who cares? Right.
And what goes into an egg cream then?
Well, it's milk and then it's the flavor and, you know, whatever flavor. If you have some berries that you want to put in there, it has some soda water to give it a little bit of spritz. It's pretty simple. Ice. It's just an old-fashioned soda counter drink.
Yeah, I remember these from suburban New York, and nobody knew even then why it was called an egg cream. And
in fact,
I think I spent the first 2 years thinking it was called a cream. So, Melanie Wagner, when we talk about things like cheese dishes and not egg creams, because I don't think you'd serve a wine with an egg cream.
No.
Beg to differ if you would. What makes the quality pairings of certain foods with certain wines? What are the keys you're looking for there?
Intensity is a big one. You don't want, you wouldn't want to serve a big, salty blue cheese with a very light, delicate Pinot Grigio. So you want to kind of match the intensity of both. I think considering the age of cheeses, if you think about really young, youthful cheeses like a fresh goat cheese or a ricotta, I like serving those with fresh, light wines like Sauvignon Blancs. And then aged cheeses like Parmigiano Reggiano could pair really, really well with bigger reds like Brunello di Montalcino. Looking to the region is always a good. You can't really do that as much in the New World, but in the Old World, if you think about, you know, regional cheeses and wines from Italy or France, those are usually a good bet that go really well together. The book, the Cowgirl Creamery books, I'm so inspired to do wine pairings with all of these recipes, though.
Oh, great.
I've got them marked, I know. We need to, our next book maybe should be together.
You know what? This sounds really fake, but I love your book.
I
love the illustrations, and I love the verbiage, and it is, I think that might be a good collaboration, actually, because we're on the same line.
I have every recipe just marked with like five or six. The thing about your recipes, like the ricotta asparagus souffle, okay, this picture, I just want to dive into this picture right here. But I have like six different wines, and there could be lots more that go with the foods. They're kind of blank canvas foods, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in a really wonderful way. Those are my favorite kinds of foods. They're foods that you know, are just very pure in their ingredients and simple in their ingredients, and so they allow for a wine to kind of shine too, or hopefully, you know. The two parts make each other better than they would have been alone.
Exactly. I mean, the whole thing, it is just about the ingredient. It's not so much about how we monkey with it, but what we have to work with.
So the when you were talking about having six different wines for that particular dish that you wanted to dive right into, and it is a simple sort of dish. Now, if it's a more complicated, more spicy dish, does that narrow the list of wines that you'd pair with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
All right. And so what are some of the wines you would offer with that?
With the ricotta asparagus souffle on page 114.
not like you're reading along or anything.
whites, for sure. I would do white wine with this. I personally, my husband makes fun of me because he says all I like to drink is white wines that are dripping with minerals and acid. But that's the kind of wines that I would serve with this. I think Sancerre would be from France with its...
Yes.
Wet rock, minerally, steely, lemony flavors would be really great. I think softer Italian whites that still had some crispiness, like Suave or Orvieto or Gavi could go really well with this. Champagne would be killer. I'm always looking for an excuse to open wines with bubbles, and champagne is an amazing food wine.
Yeah.
And I think high-quality champagne would go really well with this. And also white Bordeaux is something that I have down. So Sauvignon Blanc from the Bordeaux region, a little softer and creamier because it's usually mixed with another grape, Semillon. Any of those I think would not overpower the dish but allow it to shine and... you're making me really hungry right now.
Wow, I'm looking at the picture that you know, the ricotta asparagus souffle, and yes, it is quite impressive. Given your proximity to the wine country, Peggy Smith, at Cowgirl Creamery, have you done any ventures with wineries? Have you made any cheeses that are meant to go with certain wines or done any special issues of stuff
you know,
like that?
Well, we have, you know, that's an interesting question because we do work with a lot of wineries that they'll sell cheese in their tasting rooms and whatnot, but we've been working with Cake Bread Winery ever since we opened, and every year they have a little harvest festival, and they've invited us every year to come and be part of their little farmer's market, and then they always pair the cheese with different wines that they produce, and that's always fun to see what Brian comes up with there. The wineries and the cheesemakers in the area actually do a lot of collaborative events, and so it's just really fun to see what people will come up with. And usually the flavors work really well, mostly with the white wines and maybe with the lighter reds is what we've found in the area.
All right. Mm-hmm. Let's take a call. We have Mark in Redding on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Peggy Smith from Cowgirl Creamery and Melanie Wagner from Hello Wine.
Good morning. Yes,
I
have a question about each. Basically the same thing. Is it true that wine was originally made as a way to preserve grapes or grape juice, and that cheese was originally made as a way to preserve milk?
Interesting question. Let's take this in order. Melanie, why don't you start with the wine part? Thanks, Mark.
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I know fermentation was kind of a happy accident. So, yes, it could have definitely been because they were trying to preserve the grapes. But ever since we figured out that we could ferment things, we've been doing it, especially alcohol, which has made lots of people happy for a long, long time.
Right, when they put the grapes in the corner and thought they'd come back and get them in a little while, and wow, these have changed. And for
the better. Or there were a lot of drunk birds flying around, and they were like, what's going on over there?
They look happy.
And so, Peggy, what about the idea of cheese as a way of storing dairy?
You know, I do think that was also a happy accident, but it's been used that way for so long. Lots of people in the mountains, like the Jura Mountains, they've always made those big cheeses like they make, you know, that they could eat over the winter, and they make those big loaves of bread and that they keep in the attic. And so I do think that it may not have started out as a way to preserve, but it ended up being a really great food method.
It made a whole food in itself, sure.
Yes.
I love in Hello Wine, the little wine lies, Melanie. And number one, expensive wine is great wine. That's a little wine lie. Is it at least good? I mean, if you're going to be spending more, you're going to get something better, aren't you?
You would think that, but that's not always the case. In fact, there's a certain price point in wine. It's like the best kept secret in the wine business. It's $25 to $50 wines, where I think you get absolutely the most bang for your buck. And when I used to sell wine for distributors, it was sort of an industry assertion that if you were a producer, you wanted to avoid at all costs pricing your wine between $25 and $50 because that's where good wine went to die. Because usually consumers go into a wine store knowing that they want to spend less than $20 a bottle because it's kind of an everyday thing, or that they want to spend a lot more than that because it's a special occasion. They want to blow it out and spend, you know, $75 or $100. So this $25 to $50 region has become, in a way, it's like a secret, because it's where wineries who maybe aren't that marketing savvy, wineries who are maybe more concerned with producing a really great product and just pricing it at a fair price. And I oftentimes am much more blown away by wines in the $25 to $50 category than I am by $100 wines. And when I buy gifts for friends for their birthday, or I want to impress someone who's a wine connoisseur, I will reach for the $25 to $50 bottles before the $100. And if I feel like I have to spend $100, then I'll just buy two of the sweet spot wines. So I just wrote a blog post of my top 50 sweet spot wines on MelanieWagnerWine.com. But there's a lot of great soulful producers out there making wines in that price range.
And what about cheese? Is there a sweet spot in prices for cheese as well?
Well, I think it, you know, I will say that the cost of producing artisan foods is it's usually, it's expensive. So the sweet spot, I would say it's more important to just buy what you need instead of buying much more than you'll eat in one or two sittings. And I don't know how, I mean, I just
And you're quite clear, too, on not leaving it for more than a week or so, right?
Yeah, if you're buying, as soon as you cut into a cheese, and the same with wine, you've kind of disrupted the little ecosystem that it's set up. And the cheese and the wine both will start to deteriorate in a sense. So we always recommend that you buy a little often. You know, just.
But let's be clear that one serving is one round of Mount Tambry could be one serving.
Right.
Well, you have to make that decision yourself.
It's not necessarily the serving size listed on the package, right?
Yeah, exactly.
We have an email here from Ray in Montague, Peggy, and he says, I've been having fun this year making my own cork cheese. I wonder if there are any local resources for learning more about making cheeses.
There are a lot of websites and stuff that talk about making cheeses, and a lot of the cheese guilds around the United States are starting to offer classes for people to learn how to make cheese. But I know that Ricky Carroll has written a book, and it's I think it's called Home Cheese Making. And she has a lot of information in that book about how to make different types of cheese.
Okay, good to know, Ricky Carroll. And if there's an extension service available in your area, too, would they have any knowledge of that?
The extensions are really great. I mean, we have a couple of courses down here at our UC Extensions that lots of people go to. It's a very popular class, and people are learning a lot, I think.
Let's talk about what to put on the Thanksgiving dinner table from each of your portions of the meal. So what's a good wine with Thanksgiving, assuming you're going to have the turkey and the standard starchy things on the table as well, Melanie Wagner?
Sure. Well, turkey's not the issue. Turkey could pretty much pair with anything and be okay. It's an issue of all the other flavors that you have on the table. And it's pretty challenging because you've got sweet and savory, and maybe you have little marshmallows on your sweet potatoes, and you've got bacon and your Brussels sprouts, and there's a lot going on, and sometimes you don't even know ahead of time what's going to end up on the table. So you want an easygoing, food-friendly wine for sure. My go-to is pretty much always New World Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir has very thin skin, so it doesn't have a lot of tannin. And I say, you know, since we're on the phone with Cowgirl Creamery, make it a Sonoma Coast Pinot Noir. That's what I chose. Also, Côte de Rhones from the Southern Rhone can be nice as long as they're really juicy versions. You want something juicy, fruity, that will kind of meld all of the food flavors on the table.
Okay, and in a few seconds, a cheese recommendation from Peggy?
Well, I go with Bloomy Mold Cheeses, the white mold cheese for the beginning of the meal. That way it will just get everybody's appetite going for the meal to follow.
All right. Cowgirl Creamery Cooks is the book that Peggy Smith wrote with Sue Conley. Hello Wine from Melanie Wagner. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good. And happy Thanksgiving, one and all, from all of us at the Jefferson Exchange. Have a great holiday. Mm-hmm.